Today on Maine Calling, a listen back to some favorite snippets from some recent shows. Hi, Jennifer Rooks here, and as you've no doubt figured out, it is fundraising time here at Maine Public. As a listener to Maine Calling, you know that we strive to bring you interesting, informative, sometimes educational, and sometimes entertaining shows day in and day out. Today, we'll listen back to parts of my conversations with travel guru Rick Steves. He's always a great guest. One focused on Shakers in Maine, and another, stories of first jobs. You'll also hear a little from our show about the appeal of comic books, why we love our local libraries, summer reads, and the joy of sharing meals. We'll wrap up today's program hearing bits from our conversations about Maine county names. I hope you enjoy these programs as much as we did bringing them to you. First, this news update.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling, and I'm Jennifer Rooks. As you have no doubt figured out, it's pledge time here at Maine Public, so today we are highlighting some recent programs we are particularly fond of. We hope these shows help make the case for you to support all of the great programs you hear and watch on Maine Public. So sit back and get ready to listen to some fun, fascinating conversations. And now a little from travel expert and one of our favorite guests, Rick Steves. It occurs to me that every time we have you on Maine Calling, you are just back from somewhere. So where is it today? Where are you just back from?
Oh, a few days ago, I was in Istanbul, and that was very exciting. We were there with the TV crew making a one-hour special that you'll see on public television in Maine in the next season. And before that, I was in Rome checking it out with the Jubilee and all the commotion in Rome with people concerned about the crowds there. And we're also making a TV show there. And then in about a week or 10 days, I'm going to Barcelona and Prague to work on my guidebooks. So yeah, this is the travel season, and I've got a fun job.
Well, Rick, I want to talk about your new memoir. I just finished it and really, really enjoyed it. On the Hippie Trail, Istanbul to Kathmandu in the Making of a Travel Writer. And it occurs to me as I finish it that this book is really the origin story, why Rick Steves did not have a career as a piano teacher.
Yeah, that was, it's just a quirky, fascinating thing that has welled up in my life in the last year. I am three times as old right now is when I had that trip and wrote that book. It's my oldest book and it's my newest book at the same time. I wrote it 2 years before I ever wrote a travel book. When I wrote it, I was the happiest guy you can imagine. I was a piano teacher. I loved that work. I wanted to do it all my life. My girlfriend was a piano teacher. We were going to get married and snuggle our grand pianos together, you know. And every summer, the kids wouldn't practice, so I would say, I'm going to go travel. And on this particular trip, I was getting a little tired of Europe and I wanted to go east from Europe. I wanted to do the thing that all the backpackers and the hippies were doing. And it was called the Hippie Trail. And this is 1978. And I was 23 years old. And that was, you know, the 60s and 70s. The Beatles were going to India to hang out with the Maharishi Yogi and all the backpackers. It was the ultimate road trip. So I did this amazing, crazy road trip from Istanbul to Kathmandu. And I documented it with a 60,000-word journal. And I just diligently wrote every night in this thing. It was my tradition was to buy a 200-page hardbound empty book for every trip. And I just selfishly wrote these journals for myself. Well, this just got squirreled away and forgot about it. I probably read 4 pages of it in my whole life. And then during COVID, I had some time on my hands and I read it. And it was a fascinating anthropological dig into a 23-year-old version of myself when I didn't see myself as a travel writer. And it was rough, it was candid, it was vivid, it was unguarded, it was politically incorrect. It was just a 23-year-old kid on the road with his best friend doing the ultimate road trip. And it happened to be the perfect time in my life to do this, Jennifer, the month after I graduated from college. It happened to be the last year you could do it, because the next year the Shah was overthrown and Khomeini came in Iran. And the next year the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and became a war zone. And I happened to write this thing. It survived. And I documented it with photographs.
Allowing yourself 9 photographs a day.
That's a fascinating dimension of this. Back then, we forget that you had to carry canisters of film and you had a daily allotment. And you never knew if it was working until you got home. And then you'd mail your film in and you'd get that yellow Kodak box in the mail later, and you'd open it up and, oh, thankfully my shots all turned out. Well, this all survived and we put it in a book. My publisher did a great job of putting it there. And for me, I like the subtitle of the book, Jennifer, The Making of a Travel Writer. And I look at it as sort of it's the experiential compost pile from where my passion for teaching travel grew. And I've been going around the country giving talks about it. And it's fun to wrestle with these little ideas and to see what an impact it had on me later in my life. But one thing I learned was the value of travel information, because there was no information for that trip to speak of. And before the trip, just the semester before the trip, I took a class at our free college in Seattle, and it was on the hippie trail. And this guy was just sloppy and lazy, and he had the experience, but he didn't share it, and it really frustrated me. And then when I got home from that trip, I made a class called European Travel Cheap, because I saw the value of having learned from hard experience and sharing it with people who can benefit from it. And that's really what kicked off my career as a travel writer. In fact, the last line in the book is, I went home, turned my recital hall into a lecture hall, and started a small travel business. And that was it's just a fun experience, and it's been fun to share that. And I'm glad that people are enjoying reading it. Of course, people can buy the book with all the photographs and everything, but if you want to read it for free, you can go to my website, and it's just you look in there. You can go ricksteves.com/hippietrail, and I've got the scan of the original journal. And that is something I just wanted to make public, so people can go there and actually read it, the handwritten journal, if they want to, any old time on my website.
That was Rick Steves. It seems most people in Maine are either reading a book, writing a book, or thinking about reading or writing a book. We had the chance to get some great book recommendations during our annual Summer Reads show. Julia, I will start with you. It's a big assignment to pick the books for Read Me. How did you go about it?
Hi, thank you, Jennifer. It was such a pleasure and such an honor to have a chance to do this. I was presented with a short list of books. So I was asked to read 4 fiction books and 3 nonfiction books and come up with the selection from each one. So that is what I did. It was really fun, in particular because I got to think as a writer, but I'm also library director for Webster Library in Kingfield. So I got to think with my librarian hat on as well, which was fun.
And what were you thinking? Were you thinking, are these books that are page turners? Are these books that'll really resonate with people right now? How does the library director think about?
So what are the books that my patrons are interested in reading? What are books that will be topical and important and timely, but also engaging for my readers? And so I was so lucky to have these choices, which, both of these books do both.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk to those main authors. Nick Fuller Googans, congratulations. My first question, if you're teaching fourth grade, how do you have the energy to write novels?
Hi, Jen. Thanks so much for having me here. Today actually happens to be my first day of summer vacation. Our last day of school was yesterday. And so I write a lot over the summer, and I read a lot over the summer. So this is like to spend my first day of summer talking about books with readers. This is just the dream. Summer is a big writing time for me. And then like a lot of teachers, I get up very early and I spend that time doing a little bit of writing each day before school.
Great. So tell us about the great transition.
Well, I was also like a lot of teachers, I do some odd summer jobs. And so in the summer of 2018, I was installing solar panels for Sundog Solar shout out to an amazing solar company based out of Searsport in the Mid-Coast. And while I was doing that, I just started kind of fantasizing about, like, you know, what if there was this big kind of Green New Deal, New Deal type mobilization to try to save the world from the climate crisis? And what if I was part of that, installing solar panels? And, you know, kind of the fiction generator in my brain just ran with that. And that's what became the great transition, this idea of, like, well, what would it look like if humanity came together to try to beat the climate crisis, and what kind of new society could we build in the process?
Our show on the Shakers in Maine didn't just take us inside a unique way of life in Maine. It also shared some big news from the Shaker community. I've heard the expression hands to work, hearts to God. Is that indeed a Shaker expression?
It is. It's overused. That's why I didn't use it.
That's why you're grinning.
Yeah, I am grinning. But it's really
true.
Well,
I was hoping it wasn't sort of an urban myth, but that really is.
No, it's really true. Our founder, Mother Ann, did use it quite a bit, actually. But it's just a reminder of the fact that the two go together, right? I mean, real worship is when we're giving of ourselves to God, to our brothers and sisters, and how we're doing it manually. So the real genius of Mother Ann was the raising of physical work into a spiritual realm. Now, mind you, when we're cleaning toilets, are we thinking about that necessarily? We're not, but we probably should be, because all of that is service, no matter what it is. And in our religion, nobody was exempt from manual labor. Whether you were the first in the ministry of Maine or not, you physically worked with your hands every single day, just like the newest novice would as well. So for us, it is an act of worship. And for us, it's a necessity too. And Mother saw that.
Mm. You know, I've heard the expression shaking Quaker. Is that where the name Shaker came from? Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Jennifer. So you have done some research, which makes me very happy. That was not used very often, though. It was mostly just Shakers. And what it is, that was given to us by a newspaper reporter back in Manchester, England, where we originated in 1758. He attended a meeting and he decided that we were shaking rather than quaking. Now, if you can tell me what the difference is, I would be much beholden, because there is no difference. It's just that we are not the same as Quakers. We don't have the same origins. We don't have the same lifestyle. But that was just for the world. And probably by the 1770s anyways, you see that the Shakers, that's all they were called, the Shakers. It's not really our name, though. We're the United Society of Believers, and we term each other believers rather than Shakers. But if we put that on our signs, no one know who we were. So we long ago accepted the word Shakers.
Mm, I like that, believer. I want to ask you, because people have to come to Shakerism, as you'd said. You're celibate, so people are not born into Shakerism. Do you mind sharing your story? I understand it was back in the 1970s. How did you come to the community in Maine? And tell us about your decision to join and become a believer.
So I was a child of the late 60s, early 70s. You know, we were seeking. It definitely did not want to be my parents. And I was looking for something. I didn't know what it was. And I was searching for a lot of different things. It came about not directly, because I was 16 years old when I first went to a Shaker restoration at Hancock, Massachusetts. My parents loved history. So we were always carted around for our birthdays to different restorations in New England. And that happened to be the one. Well, my father's family knew the Shakers and knew them pretty well. In a generation before, my grandparents lived next door to someone who had been a Shaker and then returned to the Shakers and died a Shaker, Brother Ricardo Belden. And the tour guide told me something. I knew it wasn't right. I spoke to her about it, and she dismissed me because I was 16. Not because I was right or wrong, but I was 16. So I wrote to the Shakers in Maine to get this settled, and I was going back to Hancock and show that woman exactly that I was right and she was wrong. All right, so that's a problem with me I still have at the age of 68. I still have a thing about being right and not being wrong. But aside from that, so anyways, the Sabbath Day Lake Shakers wrote me a long letter. I wasn't expecting it at all. I just wanted to know about Brother Ricardo. And it turned out Brother Ted, or Brother Theodore E. Johnson, first encountered the Shakers through Brother Ricardo, and he became a Shaker because of him. So I suddenly just started writing Sabbath Day Lake. That then brought me to visit here in 1974, the day after Thanksgiving, and it changed my life. I did not want to be a Shaker at that point. However, I just fell in love with these people in this place. And then I started visiting, and in 1977, I found myself here most of the time. And Brother Ted decided I was going to be a Shaker. I did not agree with him. And he had a series of mature adult conversations with me in which he told me I was going to be a Shaker and I wasn't going to be happy if I wasn't. And anyways, what happens is on the 6th of August, we commemorate the arrival of the Shakers in America. And this last year was the 250th anniversary of that event. So we're in a year of Jubilee. And so I had a religious conversion that night, and a meeting I've never felt like that since. And that's when I decided, okay, you're right. And I went back and spoke to Brother Ted. The community accepted me. And I had some more complications at home than I thought, so I didn't arrive until January of 1978.
How many people were living at Sabbath Day Village when you arrived?
I made the seventh member.
Okay. So it's always been a small group in your life.
Yay. Yay.
Yeah. And I'm thinking...
We had as many as 12 people, and we've had as few as two.
And that's where you are now.
Nay. Nay. I am so happy to say we are three.
Really? Are you making news today, Brother?
Sure,
Brother Arnold?
We love Maine Public Radio. We always have strong supporters. Why not? So we have a new member, and her name is Sister April, and she's been with us for about a month now.
We're going to take a break. You are listening to some of our recent favorite Maine Calling programs. For details on how to listen to the entire program, visit mainecalling.org.
The stories of Maine as told on Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall, senior editor here at Maine Public, and I'm here with my colleague, Esther Pratt Kiley, taking just a few moments out of today's Maine Calling special on this first day of the summer drive. And it's our opportunity, I guess, at the top here, Esther, to say it's now is the time to support programs like this, programs that you come to depend on each and every day. And it's kind of a treat because we're hearing kind of a Whitman sampler of some of the great conversations that we've shared with you via Maine Calling over the past months, and a reminder of kind of all of the stuff that you get in the course of a Maine Calling. In this case, just a few minutes ago, a segment on the Shaker community in Maine, which is going through an interesting chapter.
Yeah, absolutely, Keith. And I was actually just at the Shaker Village yesterday, taking photos for a story on a new member of the community that we just heard a little bit about. It's the only active Shaker community in the United States. And, you know, it's a really unique and beautiful place in Maine, and it's the kind of story that you really don't understand without going to the place and spending time with the people there. And I spent a few hours there yesterday, and it's just one example of the local stories that really shine here on Maine Public. And we couldn't do those types of stories without your support. As you mentioned, Keith, now is really, it's more important than ever. There are so many reasons to support Maine Public Radio, but this service right now, more important than ever, please do your part to fuel Maine Public Radio by making a donation, calling 1-800-866-1475, or you can visit mainepublic.org/donate.
Yeah, 1-800-866-1475. We've got some volunteers here donating their time and connecting with you directly so that you can make a statement about supporting this kind of programming. So in that last segment, we heard about the Shakers. We heard from Rick Steves, a real staple of PBS for his travel programs. He's also an activist on a number of fronts and a really interesting guy who has been on Maine Public Radio and television. And also we talked about the Read to Me Summer Read series. This is a program that really connects with people in a way that encourages them to discover books, to discover plays, to discover new artistic experiences. This is the kind of programming that you depend on. Please show your support for it now. The number is 1-800-866-1475, or just go online to mainepublic.org.
Yes, in that reading segment, Keith, that you mentioned, the recommending author, poet Julia Bausma, the poet laureate of Maine, it's just another example of the local figures in Maine that, you know, we highlight on Maine Calling, the people that are really part of this community and that fuel the work we do here every day. This is an essential service. It's a public service. We're part of the community here. We're made for the community, by the community. And it's really, now is the time, because you value this service, please call 1-800-866-1475 to make a donation. And it can really be whatever amount works for you. 1-800-866-1475. Call right now, and thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to a special Best of Maine Calling. We'll get right back to listening to parts of some recent programs. But first, I want to thank you for being part of the Maine Calling community. We bring you these shows because we hope you'll find them interesting, informative, and engaging. And we always like to hear from you. Whether you call into the show, email us, or post to our Facebook or Instagram page, you are the reason we get to bring you these programs. And now, back to the segments. Who doesn't love a good bean supper?
Don't forget we had chowder suppers too, you know, not just potluck and bean suppers. Lots of organizations like Masons, you know, fraternal organizations.
So the bean supper was traditionally on a Saturday night, right? Now, was that every Saturday night or once a month? What was the tradition?
Varied a lot depending on where you were.
What about the chowder? The
same thing, you know, just whenever it seemed like a good time to do it. Or if there was a particular project coming up, people needed some money for, you know, making an improvement to their building or to solve a problem or to raise money for a family in need. If someone had lost their house to fire or there was a sickness in the family, suppers like that were thrown in order to raise, you know, a little pot of cash. The Masons here on Islesboro raised money for our preschool, for example.
Give us a sense, you know, I think a lot of young people today can't even imagine the scope of how many community suppers there were, how many people came to them, but...
I remember potlucks at the Congregational Church where my mom and dad, Christmas potluck before the holiday, Santa Claus always came to that one, and we would gather at the church, and my mother brought plates and cups and silverware from home, set it up on the table. If I wasn't there when she set the table, I always knew where we were going to sit because I recognized the plates. It was a very companionable thing to do.
Mika, from reading the work that you're involved in, I know that you are very focused on happiness and the lack of happiness that these all these studies are showing us. How does a shared meal contribute to bringing more happiness to a community?
Yeah, so a lot of my research does focus on subjective well-being, which is just sort of another way of saying happiness or how people feel about the quality of their lives. And you don't have to spend too much time with this research to figure out that sort of one of the number one predictors or the number one predictor is social connections and people's relationships with others. So part of my research recently with a few others has been looking at shared meals in particular as kind of a forum for social connection, either facilitating it or sustaining it or helping to grow it. So we recently wrote a chapter in the World Happiness Report this year that looked at the relationship between sharing meals and well-being all around the world, and then also focused on kind of a deep dive in the United States as well.
You know, it's funny. It reminds me of one time I went out, my husband and I couldn't get a restaurant reservation, so we ate at the bar, and we sat next to a man who is an inn owner from Vermont, and he said to us, "Oh, I always eat at the bar because I meet the most interesting people. When I travel, I always eat at the bar." So that may be a new line of inquiry for you in the future. And now let's listen back to some of our conversation about the role of libraries.
The Maine State Library really provides really important infrastructure to libraries throughout the state. And I would say statewide library services are especially essential for small and rural public libraries. So as Marika mentioned, the state library facilitates resource sharing through interlibrary loan, ensures that even the smallest library has access to materials from all over the state. And that is a really efficient service and a way for these tiny little libraries to provide a really broad depth of service to their patrons. And I would say the Maine State Library connects libraries throughout the state and provides really essential infrastructure.
I'd like to take a little bit of a step back, Amy. When did the idea of the public library become commonplace in the United States? And is it regional? Are there more public libraries in New England than there are, say, in Idaho or Florida? Or is this pretty much everywhere?
So the history of public libraries, really the libraries in the United States initially were subscription-based, so you had to pay to be a member of the library. So it was a pretty significant shift to provide free public libraries, public library resources. Andrew Carnegie, when he funded libraries, he had many libraries built throughout the country. There was a stipulation that the operating budget had to come from taxes. So he was building a base of not only library buildings, but also the support had to come from the local community. So that is a pretty significant shift and definitely provides really great access for people. Libraries also were one of the first professions open to women. So a lot of women were library leaders, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, as public libraries became much more common throughout the country. In terms of New England, I would say we have probably more local public libraries than other parts of the country. So many parts of the country have a countywide library system. Here in Maine, we have over 250 public libraries. So we have some very small libraries, and the funding for libraries is very localized. And so that is somewhat different from other state models.
Well, you're speaking to us from a small library in Northeast Harbor. Kelly is joining us from what I believe is the state's largest library. And Kelly, the Portland Public Library isn't just one building, right? Even though people might be familiar with that spectacular facade on Congress Street.
No, it isn't. The downtown library on Monument Square is our largest building, but we have branches throughout the neighborhoods in Portland, and including a branch on Peaks Island that is only accessible by ferry. We also have a bookmobile that travels to neighborhoods in Portland that do not have access to a library, and a small outreach department that serves homebound patrons.
How do you and your colleagues, other members of the staff, think about the public library in Portland? Do you use words like, you know, people come here to borrow books, or do you use, I don't know, do you think of it as community building? I don't want to put words in your mouth. How do you, when you're having a meeting and you're deciding what to do next, what are your goals? What is your philosophy?
I think in the first thing that we think about is patron-driven services. So knowing our community, knowing who is coming into our building and maybe who we aren't seeing, and how we can serve those unique populations. So it's a very customer service-driven profession, public librarianship. And I would agree that, you know, I'm almost tired of telling people who haven't been to a library in a while that it's not just books, or people that dismiss it as just books. It's so much more than that. If you come downtown, especially any day of the week after school, we have a vibrant teen library that is filled with 50 to 60 Portland public school students that use the library all day, because we're right next door to the Boys and Girls Club. We're right next door to Portland High School. We're up the hill from King Middle School. And so that's incredible. We have free events, large events, small events throughout the week. And people use the library for a variety of reasons. Our children's library has a play area that has become a popular place for parents to come and just have like parent time, where they can just hang out and meet other parents. So while we are books, and we have plenty of those, and we hope that people are making use of our materials, it is more of a community destination that's absolutely free and open and welcoming to everyone.
Now, let's hear a little about the joy of comic books.
Traditionally, people think of the superhero comics because the property's been used for movies and TV and things of that nature. But the reality is there is something for everybody. They're everything from, we have comic cookbooks. I mean, it's amazing, the variety, and for all ages and all tastes. Historical, classic adaptations, LGBTQ books, you name it. There's something for any audience out there. And it's not just the traditional periodicals, the you know, comic books, it's the graphic novels as well.
So you mean like comic books, it's a series, you keep going to the next one, but a graphic novel is contained.
Right. So the periodical comics are the things that come out each month. You know, they're 32 pages or whatever. The graphic novels tend to be, you know, in a paperback form. Most times now they are original material, or they are collected periodicals brought into book form.
What else are people coming in for at your store? There's manga, there's alternative forms.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great, obviously the Japanese-inspired manga is very popular. The all-ages material that's out there now, which we did not see until probably the last 15 to 20 years, the depth of all-ages material, everything from Dog Man to Bone to, you know, historically it was like Tintin and Asterix and, you know, maybe some Donald Duck. And now we have shelves upon shelves upon shelves of things. It's endless how much material there is.
And these are not a new thing. Comic books actually go quite a ways back, right? Even the superhero ones. Can you give us a little history in a nutshell?
Yeah, in a nutshell, back in the 1930s or so, they realized that they could reprint the newspaper comic strips in a book form and sell them. And they'd already done the work. So it's like, oh, we'll just collect them. And like things like Famous Funnies was one of the titles and things of that nature. They'd collect Tarzan or whatever was popular in the newspapers. Once they realized how well they were selling, they didn't have enough content to fill them. So they started creating original content just to do in comic book form. And that was in the late 1930s. That's when we got Superman, Batman, Captain America, and those things. And from there, it just took off.
Wow. Okay. Well, Isabel, I want to turn to you. You're an artist and you create things that fit into this comic arts world. Tell us what you focus on.
I'm what you call an indie creator. So I work independently and I write and illustrate my own stuff. My work kind of falls into two categories. I do narrative comics, which I sort of use to like explore my emotions and things I'm going through in my life to like create a story other people can enter into. And I also do educational comics that are for anywhere from middle grade to teens to college students.
So does this all, I've heard the term sequential art as sort of a catch-all for what ties these together. I mean, they're actually images that you follow as a story. Is that what you would say the common thread is to what you do?
Yeah, to define comics, I use Scott McCloud's definition from his graphic novel Understanding Comics, which is juxtapose images in deliberate sequence. So just a series of images that go together in a certain order that usually tell a story, sometimes with words and sometimes not. So generally, I think of comics as pictures that you feel like you're reading instead of just looking at. And then as far as subject matter, it can be absolutely anything.
So this show is part of our Passions and Pastimes series. And the reason we picked this is because some people are very, very passionate about comic books. And Isabella, I'll turn to you for what do you think it is about this format, or what is it that makes people collect them and kind of obsess over them?
Well, I can kind of come into it at the graphic novel angle and like the independent comics angle of things. I think that the combination of like story and art is really, really powerful. And that combination does something that you can really only do in film. Is really the only other medium where you can control both like the visuals and the dialogue and the text of what's going on. And I think it really draws a lot of people in. And I also think that the market for young readers in comics right now is like absolutely exploding. I think comics offer a really great way to like get young people into reading who might otherwise not. I was actually looking up some statistics, and a report from the School Library Journal in 2023 found that 90% of public librarians and 83% of school librarians suggest graphic novels to students who struggle with reading, because having those images and text together really just helps so much with that kind of understanding.
What about you, Rick? What would your thoughts be on what drives the passion for comics, especially the traditional comic books?
Well, I mean, having an ongoing story, it's always fun to have a character you can relate to and follow. So whether it's you're following what's happening with Spider-Man or Batman, or whether it's something a little more obscure, you know, it's you're brought into this other world, which I think is amazing. And making that comparison with like a big budget film and to comics, you can do something in a comic that would cost billions or millions or whatever to do in a big budget film. But if you can draw it You can create it. You can create a planet. You can create an entire universe. And it's up to your imagination to create whatever it is you want. And I think that's one of the appeals of comics, is that, you know, there's just so many potential stories. It's whatever you can think up.
Jennifer here, reminding you that today we are listening back to some recent programs in the hope that they will inspire you to make a donation to Maine Public. We have a lot of fun and put in a fair amount of work to bring you these programs. Please take a moment to support programs like Maine Calling, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and so many more.
Good morning. You are listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. My name is Esther Pratt Kiley, and I'm here with my colleague, Keith Shortall, as part of Maine Public's summer fundraiser. Call 1-800-866-1475 with your donation now, or you can give online at mainepublic.org/donate. And Keith, it's really unlike any pledge drive we've done before. This is our first fundraiser since federal funding for public broadcasting was suddenly eliminated. Community support has really always been the backbone of Maine Public. We just heard on Maine Calling about public libraries being an essential service in the community, and Maine Public is also an essential service, providing free programming to the entire state. And you know, just like public libraries, Maine Public requires resources, funding to provide this public service. That's why your support is really more important now than ever before. So because you value this local programming, please call 1-800-866-1475 right now and make your contribution. Again, that's 1-800-866-1475.
Yeah, we share a lot with libraries in terms of being this kind of public institution from which people get, you know, not just information, but inspiration. And it's you know, if you, anyone who lives in Maine has a local library that they depend on, we're similar to that, come through the airwaves for that, but in this, it's the idea of this publicly supported institution. As you've pointed out, as we're all fully aware of, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been defunded. It means $5 million for us over 2 years. But let's be clear, we're not going anywhere. We're going to keep our eyes on the mission, as we always have. And as we always have, we're going to turn to you. And together, we're going to keep doing what we do. $10 a month, $35 a month, $60 a month, whatever you can do it's going to make the difference as to we do this together and continue on. The number 1-800-866-1475. That's 1-800-866-1475, or go online to mainepublic.org.
And we have some amazing volunteers here answering the phones. So again, you can call 1-800-866-1475. And, you know, Keith, you and I are both on the news team here at Maine Public. And, you know, I don't think we can stress enough just how important trustworthy local journalism is today. Again, now more than ever. Maine Public, we believe it's important for everyone to have access to deeply researched and meticulously reported local news. It's a pillar of our community. It's extremely important. It's really a foundation of our community, of our democracy. And so there's really a great variety of news and local reporting at Maine Public, and your support goes a long way in helping us do that work every day. We do that work with you, for you, and for the community. So call 1-800-866-1475. Make your contribution today, mainepublic.org/donate, 1-800-866-1475, and thank you so much for your support.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are dipping into our archives to listen back to parts of some recent standout shows. We're doing this to remind you of the kind of programming your support of Maine Public helps bring to the airwaves. Now, back to the show. Do you recall your first job? We had a good time hearing from many people, both known and not so well known, about what they remember about their first job. A new feature on the Maine Public smartphone app is a quick and easy way to record a message. It is called Talk to Us, and we received a few Talk to Us messages about people's first jobs. Here is Jeff from Cushing.
I'm retired now. My first job was at the beginning of my college year. I took a job at Rhinebeck Aerodrome in Rhinebeck, New York, catching airplanes. World War I airplanes were shown off there. They don't have brakes. So the problem is, as they landed, they may wander right or left in what's called a ground loop, either hitting the trees or the spectators. So they hired us crazy kids to dress up in a German uniform and stand alongside the runway. And as the planes came down, we would grab their wing and guide them straight so they wouldn't hit anything. I learned from that you really need to keep your eyes open and look up, because you never know where your next job opportunity is coming from.
That is quite an unusual first job, but his lesson, keep your eyes open. We have a caller you might have heard from, an epidemiologist, attorney, former principal director at the U.S. CDC. Dr. Shaw, welcome back to the show and welcome back to Maine.
Thank you so much, Jen. It is great to be home.
So what was your first job?
My first job was right after college. I worked at a small independent bookstore just outside of where I went to college. It's sadly no longer, but it was a great experience for me, especially because I loved books. And so for a guy who loves books, to be able to hang out around books and talk to people about books and recommend books was a great opportunity. But I'll tell you what I really learned from that job was how to have a boss and how to eventually become one. I had a wonderful, wonderful manager and boss named Connie. She was clear. She was direct. She spelled out what needed to be done. And she did so clearly, directly, and with a lot of compassion. And what I really learned from her and from that entire experience was something I try to do to this day, which is when something doesn't go right, which of course it always happens, make sure your boss hears about it from you before anybody else, and make sure you go to your boss with a plan and not a problem. And that was something I learned very early on in that job, and something I've kept with me to this day.
Dr. Nirav Shah, formerly with the U.S. CDC, and we'll go now to Torbert in York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guest. It's 1960. I'm 16 years old, and I'm eager to start my first job at a seaside restaurant as a grill man, doing hot dogs and hamburgers and manning the takeout window. So the boss, and I said, well, what am I going to get paid? And he says, I'll give you between 75 cents and a dollar and a quarter, depending on what you're worth. So I worked my little tail off, 60 hours the first week, 70 hours the second week, coated in grease, but looking forward to it. I'm going to get that top money. And at the end of 2 weeks, I said, where's my pay? He said, here it is. And he gave me a check for $90 or thereabouts. I said, what's this? He said, well, that's what you're worth. I said, the heck I am. I worked my tail off for you. And I got compliments from my fellow workers and from the customers. And he said, well, that's what you're worth to me. I said, well, I quit. I walked out the door, and the waitresses said, what's going on? I told them, and they said, well, we quit, too.
You are listening to a special Best of Maine Calling. The wonderful Katie Zerilli took us back to when we used to sing the county song. So we'll have some fun because we're talking about counties. And Katie, I have to ask you, when you were a kid, did you learn the county song?
Yes, I did.
Did you know that there are two versions? I just learned this in doing research for today's program.
Wait, now what do you mean? What do you mean two versions?
Well, if you go on the State of Maine's website, they play two versions. So we're going to play one now, and then a little bit later we'll play another version. So, and on the State of Maine website, I believe it's the Secretary of State page, it's two different schools singing. So here's the first version. Okay, is that the one you learned, Katie?
I think I know the other one.
You think you know the other one?
Yeah.
Jess, is that ready? Can we play the other one? Okay, let's go.
Let's go.
That's the one.
That's the one.
The one with a zippier pace.
Yeah, let's speed it up, you know?
Okay, so go ahead.
It was like, I think it was like, it was fourth grade, right? I feel like there was like a main like curriculum that everybody learned.
Did you learn anything about the counties or did you just learn the song?
Oh no, I think we just learned the song. But I do remember, okay, I remember, and I don't know if this came from the, I'm pretty sure it was in that, probably the curriculum. I just remember being, you know, growing up in Kennebec County and learning about like Aroostook County and these kids who got 3 weeks off school to pick potatoes. Like, I was like, wait, they have to start school earlier. I remember that was the one, that's like my one takeaway from anything specific I learned about the counties.
And did that really strike you as wrong or did that strike you as great?
I think I was like, well, they have to start school earlier, like in the summer. Like, that must be kind of a bummer at the time.
Yeah.
Like, I think I was stressed out about that.
So we talked about a couple of them already. We've talked about Franklin and Lincoln. Tell me about some of your other characters. I mean, York is pretty fancy.
York is fancy. Yeah, and I actually did like a little brief stint in York just this summer, like a couple months long, because we had moved back home, but we were living with my sister and brother-in-law because we obviously finding a house isn't the easiest thing in the world, especially when you live in Maryland. So we were kind of trying to figure it out. So we were kind of temporarily in York County. And I obviously observed, and it was the summer. So there, it was very packed with the tourists and like Massachusetts plates and everything like that. And obviously also observing like some of the York County residents being like, yeah, no, we're just going to be full with Massachusetts people for the whole summer. And so, I don't know. I think I just kind of like picked up like that vibe, and then like obviously like the kind of the coastal beachy, and kind of I just kind of also figured that like York County, it's the farthest away from Aroostook County, so I think I always kind of have like York and Aroostook coming together, because York's just going to be like, what's going on, like why are we talking about potatoes and all that stuff like that. So
that is funny. And I like, is it Piscataqua that really doesn't like other people very much?
Yeah. and that's one of the ones where I was like, or that's one, you know, I'm sure I've been there, but not a ton. Like I know I've probably been there a little bit. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to look up some stuff and do some research and then do kind of my best take on it. And that was another one where I got a comment and they were like, you nailed us in Piscataqua. So it was cool.
Have you, since you started doing these, made an effort to do a little more traveling around the state? I mean, I think you had said you lived in three counties, but I think it counts as four if you spent a couple months in York County.
I mean, if Jennifer Rook says it's four, I'm going for it. Like, that's four. Well, for what I'm doing with content creation and social media too, I am kind of traveling a little bit more. But I think definitely, like, I was recently in Hancock County. I think what it does is when I'm in the different counties, I like try to pay attention better too. Mm-hmm. Like, cause I don't just want to do like surface level, right? You know, like what everybody would know. I want somebody who's like in, you know, Saginaw to be like, yes, how did she possibly know that, you know, that is. So I thought, you know, I'm kind of trying to pay a little bit more attention.
Thank you for listening to today's program. And don't forget, as a listener, we consider you part of the Maine Calling team and the entire Maine Public family. You've likely heard the news about funding cuts to public radio and public television. If you value shows like Maine Calling and the other offerings on Maine Public Radio and TV, please take a moment to take part in our summer pledge drive. Thank you.
Maine Calling is made possible by listeners who donate and by Center Street Arts Gallery, artist-owned and operated, now open 7 days a week in historic downtown Bath, Center Street Arts Gallery, LLC, and Dean Sweets, specializing in hand-dipped, nut-free, and gluten-free chocolates, celebrating over 20 years in Portland and at deansweets.com.
Now is the time to help secure a robust future for Maine Public. Hi, I'm Keith Shortall, senior editor here at Maine Public, and I am here with my colleague, Esther Pratt Kiley, and we're taking just a few minutes out of the programming here on this first day of the summer drive, in this case, Maine Calling, a staple of your daily listening, and I'm sure that it's part of your daily life. And Esther, we're hearing this kind of cool sampling of some of the past conversations, the highlights of some of the shows that we've shared over the months. And one is one of them was your first job. And I remember my first job in radio was in commercial radio doing midnight to 6 a.m.
I didn't know this.
Yes, on a commercial station. And I moved on from there to public to Maine Public and have been here now for 35 plus years. And I can tell you that in that time, I've seen a lot of Sturm und Drang, lots of chapters here. We're in a period of Sturm, as you know, here in terms of federal funding, but the Drang doesn't have to be that bad because we're all going to work together to get through this and become even more robust. To do that, you just call, become a member. If you've already pledged, thank you. You can up that pledge, up your donation. The number is 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainpublic.org.
Keith, I think that's such an important message because, you know, you hear a lot about the funding cuts. And yes, it is, it's a big deal, but it's also we're not going anywhere. We're determined. We are still here providing this essential service to you every day, and you are a huge, huge part of that. Your support goes a long way here at Maine Public. For all of the local programming that we do here, you are a huge part of that. So you can call 1-800-866-1475 to make a donation right now to fuel this essential public service. And you know, Keith, you mentioned that this is a sampling right now on Maine Calling of some of the favorite episodes. And, you know, Maine Public is really unique because it reaches across the entire state, bringing news and local programming to all 16 counties. And we were just hearing a little bit about that on Maine Calling, how each county really has its own unique character and vibe. And, you know, Keith, we had a really unique reporting project recently where we looked at how climate change is impacting the state in each county. We went to each county in the state, and it really highlighted how unique each corner of Maine is. And that's why having the resources to reach every corner of the state is essential. So with your support, we can continue that work. We can be far-reaching and in-depth and really bring the news to you and the community. So please call 1-800-866-1475 or mainpublic.org/donate. Make a donation today.
The 16 counties song is now in my head. And I've known there's
can
two
you sing it?
I can, but I won't. And there's two different versions so that we always have fights over that. But it's something we learned in elementary school. But yes, it's a big state. And I also just wanted to say NPR is such a big part of our daily mix, but of course we do have this local element. That's what makes Maine Public Maine Public. And so, you know, there's Irwin in the morning and you get your weather from Lou McNally. Then at Maine Calling, there's Jen Rooks, as we've just heard, Cindy Hahn. Sometimes they even let me host this program. Maine Public is there for you. It's your neighbors. It's people you see in the grocery store. They're the reporters, they're the hosts, and they connect this content to you. We've been doing it for more than 60 years. We intend to continue doing that with your help. The number 1-800-866-1475 to make a donation. You can do it online if it's easier. If that's too many numbers, just go to mainpublic.org.
Yeah, and we really have a range of programming, as you mentioned, Keith. You know, it's not just here on the radio airwaves. You can find our reporting and other programs across digital platforms, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. You can really access these quality local stories wherever you are and in the place that you really like to find your news and entertainment. So if you're invested in this kind of work and really the access to quality local programming wherever you are, please donate today and call 1-800-866-1475 and head to mainpublic.org/donate.
And, you know, we should talk about this cool gift that we're offering. The famous, of course, you know, Maine Public bags, which everyone is aware of. But this is different this year, Esther. This is, we have a really specially designed Original and exclusive design by the main artist, Eric Hopkins, who I see up in the Midcoast all the time. He's a great person and a good, powerful supporter of Maine Public. And he has created this this image of a Maine mourning on these bags, which are yours for $50 a month for the medium size, $60 a month for the large size. All you'd have to do is 1-800-866-1475, and you can get that bag. Check it out online. It's a really cool bag.